something so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play Doom.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, welcome to the first Toy Department of 2016.
Whoa. We made it. We made it into our second year. Like, I think that's a mark of a successful podcast.
I've been on some podcasts that haven't made it that long.
As have I. We may have been on a podcast together that didn't make it quite that long.
Indeed. So year number two, we got it on all the checks now, right? It feels good. What'd you do over Christmas break there?
Oh my! I left the Bay Area right around, what was it, the 29th. So I did Christmas in the Bay Area. Christmas was great for me, actually, because I was doing Warriors stuff. I got to go watch the Warriors and the Cavaliers and talk about it on the radio, which was delightful. And then I went to New York for a week. Just got back yesterday, and it was great. I saw a lot of Phish concerts. I hung out with a lot of people that I knew in what seems like a former life, and I enjoyed New York for, I think, actually a couple more days than anyone needs to.
Yes, I was just about to say, no offense to the city of New York, but that is a... you want to do the three-day visit to New York, or the, you know, maybe the four.
Yeah. I mean, what I kind of did was, like, 4 days of Phish concerts and then 3 days of more New York. Yeah. But it's just, it's, yeah, it's cold and it's harsh and it's, I don't love New York.
I don't have
one of those shirts.
It's an effort there, man. Everything is an effort, you know?
Yep.
And so 7 days of that can be trying. I feel like Vegas, I feel like, is another city.
Oh, God.
I enjoy Vegas, but you don't want to be in Vegas for a week.
I would never. Now, the difference between Vegas and New York is, like, in New York, if you know some people, you can at least kind of settle in and do normal stuff with normal people, whereas Vegas, you can't. So I couldn't do Vegas for a week. I would just die.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, both of those places, though, have that, like, hey, well, you can stay out all night vibe.
I had a couple moments of, like, walking out of a concert or a bar in the middle of the night with friends and being like, man, is there anything where we can get some food right now? And everyone being like, there's everywhere we can
everywhere.
Get food.
Well, let me tell you, trying to get food at Minneapolis at 4 in the morning is its own special
challenge. Heck, you can't
even
do it in San Francisco. You can't do it.
It's the painfully few places in San Francisco. In fact, you get to know them all really quick.
That's
but
right.
you at least have the delightful selection of taquerias
that's
are available
true.
Till like 2:33, which is
that's
pretty,
right
pretty
the
strong.
Late night taqueria is San Francisco's great treasure. That's certainly true.
Yeah, also shout out to Golden Boy Pizza in North Beach late night.
Wow.
The little
okay.
Square pie. Yeah, it's good.
All
stuff
right. Square pie.
Miss that guy.
My old friend the pizza man.
Oh yeah, they knew me. All right, so some stuff happened while we were gone. I wanted to ask you about one thing I thought was an interesting follow-up. George Lucas gave some interviews, you know, while we were gone over the break.
Probably a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, well, definitely. He compared Disney to white slavers, which got a lot of headlines, and maybe if you just pull that quote out, yeah, exactly. It's kind of an oh god, and I don't really think he meant it that way. I don't think.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. The general point that I wanted to make was that I think George Lucas had some of the same issues with the movie that I did, just in terms of, I thought it would have been more interesting if they developed a new story rather than graft on the old one. And my question to you is, does George Lucas saying this help or hurt my case, given what he's done with the last couple of franchise movies?
I think it hurts your case. Because I think it's pretty straightforward that, you know, all your criticisms being taken into account of sort of repetition. And the friend I stayed with in New York actually is more on your side. I mean, all three of us liked the movie, and I think that's important to keep mentioning. But yeah. He is more with you in terms of, okay, but it really was just a blow-for-blow remake of stuff that's happened before, and et cetera, et cetera. Clearly, J.J. Abrams and company valued resurrecting the franchise from an emotional standpoint over creating exciting new content in a meaningful way. And I think that was the right decision. Now, you could argue, why not do both? But George Lucas did neither.
Yes, that's true. And I guess I would just say it's like, yes. I mean, I think I definitely would not only make that argument of, yeah, like, why are we just settling for one? And would it be necessary, you know, even if you say that, you know, resurrecting the glory or the good feeling of the franchise is the most important priority, is it necessary to just remake the movie to do that? Like, couldn't you do that while making an original story? Is that the only road to
no?
To
of course, theoretically,
a good feeling.
Hopefully, theoretically, you could, and hopefully that is still in the offing with the many, many more Star Wars movies that we're going to be watching over the next decade. But it's not a hard choice for me between the two, and I think they made the right one. And again, I'm not saying they consciously were like, well, if we're going to make this feel like Star Wars, we've got to do the exact same things they did in other Star Wars movies that were good. But I can understand falling into that trap a little bit, saying, I want to bring us back to the original glory of Star Wars. All right, what did they have? And we should have some family drama and some family secrets. And we should have, you know, someone turning, someone who was a, you know, potential great force of good turning bad, and we should have a giant evil planet or we should have a big base that's a problem, but no, well, this time we'll make it a planet instead of just a big spaceship. And I can understand how you tried to touch the right touchstones and you ended up going back to old touchstones. I understand how that happens.
Alright, well, I think it'll trouble me for a while to come.
Probably till like mid-2017 when the next one comes out.
Well, you know, there's going to be one this year. It's not going to be in the, you know, in the series of the nine, but there's going to be a Star Wars movie this year.
It's Rogue One, right?
Yeah, scale of 1 to 10, like, how excited are you about that prospect right now?
Pretty excited, because that one, from what I've heard, can't help but be a totally fresh, distinct movie. It's like, it's more of like a spy action epic than it is a Star Wars epic in some ways. It's a mission. It's a bunch of soldiers who don't have powers on a mission.
Yeah, and look, if there's anything you could say, the good feeling of nostalgia bought maybe from these movies is you definitely give Star Wars the benefit of the doubt now. Right?
I think
I had a healthy skepticism going into this one.
And relating to where we started, we're giving them some rope because it's not George Lucas anymore. And so George Lucas, having problems with what happened, in my eyes, is like, well, welcome to the club, big guy, because we all got big problems with your last three. So,
Yeah. Well, that's probably why he's excited to bitch, right?
I think
like,
so.
Oh,
I think
my turn.
he part of that has to be, hey, man, like, you guys gave me a ton of shit for every little thing that went wrong, you know? So, like, how come these guys are getting off so easy when they did all these things wrong?
Yeah. It's like, I see a glaring flaw here, people. all right. I want to ask you about something else that sort of has permeated our conversations in previous podcasts. And I think it's interesting. We've talked some. I sent you a text over the break that was essentially a text that I've sent to, I don't know, maybe 20 people. Dude, you need to be watching Making a Murderer.
Yeah.
And you were kind of like, nah, man, I told you I'm not in on feel bad TV.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to watch something and then afterwards be like, so great. Now I know that, like, there are horrible things happening to people that are turning them into murderers all over the country. And I know that may not be exactly the plot of the show. I don't know much about it other than like several people being like, it's so good. It's Real Little Murderers. Blah.
I'm impressed with how little you know about it at this point.
Well, I'm pretty good at willfully ignoring things, you know. So I do that with most, frankly, most nonfiction of the news and entertainment variety.
I feel like this show, I think, really kind of almost succinctly, in a way, makes the case for Feel Bad TV. In the sense that you realize how just invigorating or exhilarating it is to watch TV that really makes you feel something strongly. Yeah. Even if that something isn't good. And, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it and say that you're going to walk away from this feeling great about America and where we're at, because it's clearly not designed to do that, without saying too much about it for people who haven't watched it at this point.
Yeah.
But what I will say is you'll be interested, and I can reveal this. So I watched it over the Christmas portion of the break. My girlfriend came to visit for New Year's, and I'm like, I think you might like this show. She was like really skeptical. She's like, I don't watch dark things. It's a documentary. I put one on and she's like obsessed. We binged the whole thing that weekend. So I've now seen it twice.
Oh man. You've watched it twice.
I've watched it twice.
Aren't you just so sad about America?
Angry, I think maybe.
Okay.
Might be
angry. But, yeah. That's not much better.
But I'm also, I have some sense of hope that maybe, you know, an injustice here could be righted.
Let me ask
you know,
you this.
There's that part of it. And for me, there's a hunger for more information. I'm down the rabbit hole. I watched Fox News last night just so I can see interviews with the prosecutor and the defense attorney from the show.
We are recording.
That's how far down the hole I am.
We're recording via Skype today, which is, you know, usually we're using radio studios, but I'm still transitioning back to going back to work from my vacation. So I am not in today. So we chose to do via Skype, and I don't know if you noticed. But that gives us the benefit of video, and when you just said that, I did a double take at your video. Here's the thing. Let me ask you this. Without spoiling it, acknowledging that it's about a real maybe murderer. Do you think? Again, without giving it away, hopefully, that whatever the unjust outcome is actually likely to be changed as a result of a Netflix true crime show? Is that real?
Okay. Oh, God, I'm trying to figure out just the way to answer this without giving away too much.
Because here's the thing. Here's my simple point. If that's true, whether or not it makes me want to watch it more, it makes me feel differently about the importance of it.
All right, so let me put it this way. So there are two. First of all, there's two people involved in this, right? There are two people who were accused of the crime. The show, just for like a bullet point perspective, is about a guy in Wisconsin who is arrested for rape in the mid '80s for the rape of this woman. And it turns out, you know, maintains his innocence through 18 years in prison. Eventually, DNA evidence is found and he's freed.
Right.
2 years later, he's accused of another murder. Then the show sort of focuses on his trial and whatnot.
Right.
So, in the second murder, there is a relative of his who's involved, who's also, you know, also goes to trial. The relative's case for his conviction being overturned is, you know, stronger.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's more likely. But the incredible amount of interest and the incredible number of people who believe that there was an injustice here currently does make it more likely that new evidence, which is what you know, this guy would probably need at this point could be discovered.
Be found. Right.
So is it likely? Legally, no, but it's way more likely than it would have been without this show airing. You know what I mean? So,
well, in that sense, then it's probably an important thing. I mean, look, it's always good when documentarians, whatever you want to call them, people expose, reporters, people expose poor work by police or expose injustices that are happening. Like, great, fix injustice whenever you can. I'm on board with that. I just don't know that I need to see the gory details, as it were.
But the entertainment is in the details. Like, for me to say, like, you know, so-and-so got a raw deal without you understanding what went into it, it's just not the same effect. But, you know, like, you can understand the basic points of the story and just be shocked watching the thing. You know, the point that it makes about what it's like for poor people, rural people trying to get justice in America, I think are interesting.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this, just all of that aside, like, how important is it for you to be connected to these sort of cultural things that, you know, everyone's watching and talking about? Like, obviously, this is the show that is currently dominating the cultural conversation. How important for you is it to be able to have a viewpoint in that conversation?
It's a strange answer. The answer is critically important. I find it incredibly important. However, certain things I don't mind missing one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I want to be in on those conversations as a general rule. That's why I probably know more of Drake's music than I need to. That's why I probably have seen more TV than could possibly be considered necessary, or why I've gone to see particular movies. Like, I probably, if I had not been, and this isn't maybe not the great example, but if it had not been so in the zeitgeist and sort of stayed there for longer than I expected, maybe I don't see a movie like Jurassic World, because I don't especially care. Something like this, though, when I have a, like, I care not to see super depressing stuff. I really do. And that might be irresponsible on certain levels, and it might be childish, but I'm pretty okay with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I would make the case to you, other than, you know, the fun of actually being a part of this conversation, which is crazy fun and interesting, that I just think this movie makes this show, I guess I should say, makes the case for how something that's kind of a bummer can be an enjoyable experience to watch.
Yeah.
Maybe you should watch it just on those grounds of, like, hey, see how this thing that will certainly make you angry can also be entertaining. So
there's also there's like an impotence to the anger. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I suppose there is. Although, I mean, what's encouraging to me is the idea of, like, how many people, like, actually want to do something.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, but isn't, and we should probably stop short of what of the conversation that I'm now pushing us towards. But generally speaking, when something like this gets its story told, do you really feel like, oh, good, and we caught another one, or do you more feel like, holy Jesus, how much must this stuff be happening that we're not aware of? Because I usually go the latter way, and it's incredibly depressing.
I think there's a little bit of both. I think there's a little bit of both in this story. I mean, yes, you do feel like, man, this, you know, the system is stacked up against a lot of people and meant to perpetuate convictions and meant to get people to plea or confess, you know.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, like that's a thing. But there's also, I mean, this case is such an outlier.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
To find a man who is not only exonerated, and also exonerated in, like, a really definitive way.
Right.
Where it's like, it wasn't like, oh, this piece of evidence casts new doubt over whether or not this guy did the crime.
It was like he obviously did not do it.
It was not only did he not do it, now we know who did.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, so it was like, you know, it was very cut and dry that he was wronged. And then to be accused of a high profile crime so quickly afterwards, you know, and among there's just all these other details, and I won't get into the details about the second case, but just crazy details in the second case and things like that. Like, it's such an outlier kind of story that you know, while you certainly acknowledge, like, this probably happens a lot and is representative of some universal problems in the justice system, it's also a very specific story at the same time.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. I'm half sold anyway. We'll see what happens.
You're going to cave because people...
I'm probably going to cave.
It's going to come up at parties and stuff, and you're just going to feel left out. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Do you have a big one? Because for me, when you mention this, I'm like, oh, yeah, I do that too. And for me, it's Titanic.
Ugh.
To this day, I've never seen Titanic, and I never will.
Congratulations, man. Yeah. That's all I can say. I don't know what most people tell you, but you did the right thing. It's trash. It's utter trash, and it's still the... In an Oscar landscape filled with ridiculous injustice at every turn, it is the most absurd Oscar gaffe in the history of the Oscars, undoubtedly, in my mind.
Really?
See, just to the fact that it was a decorated film to the degree that it was, when it should not have even been nominated for a single thing besides the special effects.
Costume.
Nah. I mean, fine, maybe. What do I know? I'd have to go back and look at the costume nominees. The one scene with the boat breaking was pretty awesome to look at. Otherwise, it might be the worst acting performances of both Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet's careers.
Wow.
It's trash. It's a trash movie, a trash story, and it's absolutely embarrassing how decorated it is as a piece of film.
I'm still going with Forrest Gump over Pulp Fiction in the Oscar.
But Forrest Gump is great.
No, Forrest Gump is not great. Forrest Gump is trash. It's treacly trash.
Okay. Well,
in a year in which I want to say Goodfellas was also nominated that year. I may have to look that up.
What's that, 94? 94 Oscars?
I believe it's the 94 Oscars, yeah.
67th Academy Awards.
You got it right there?
I don't know. I'm making sure it's the right one. Yes, Forrest Gump. 6 awards, 13 nominations, Best Picture. The other Best Picture nominees were Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, 4 Weddings and a Funeral, and The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, The Shawshank, yeah!
I would say, to be fair, that probably all 4 of those, if not at least Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, and Shawshank, are better than Forrest Gump. Yeah, but I don't think Forrest Gump is trash. I think Forrest Gump is a good movie.
It's trash. It makes no sense.
I will say... Sam Jackson also got ripped for Best Supporting Actor that year because Ed Wood is another mediocre at best film, and Martin Landau won for playing Bela Lugosi. I could just get really mad about this whole...
That's not something you might be interested in?
No. He's great. It's not a problem with Landau. And he's pretty good as Bela Lugosi. He and Johnny Depp are both enjoyable in that movie. It's just a bad movie.
I don't think I saw that movie. Johnny Depp, not my flavor.
No?
No.
Huh.
No. I think he's wildly overrated.
Well, fine. Look, again, for me, the Titanic is the worst, and you're either way, you're right to have not seen it, because it's 3 hours you'll never get back.
Yeah.
Also, Good Will Hunting was the year of Titanic, and just so superior in every way as a film.
Yeah. Although that movie, Age hasn't been completely kind to Good Will Hunting.
That's true, but... I think sometimes, like, this is a total, it's going to sound a little bit like a non sequitur. Green Day is and always has been one of my favorite bands. And I think in some ways time has not been kind to Green Day just because so much has happened with the Sum 41s and Blink 182s of the world that they don't look as good in retrospect. And there have been a lot of, like, Good Will Hunting was kind of on the front end of a certain type of indie film. And that genre may have soured in a way that's not Good Will Hunting's fault. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But some of that's true for Pulp Fiction too, in a way.
Yeah. Oh, that movie's still great. Oh, yeah, such a good movie.
So great though.
Did you see Hateful Eight?
I have not seen Hateful Eight.
Okay, we'll postpone that then. But I would recommend to you and everyone that if it's possible near where you live, go see the 70mm Roadshow version. It's a blast.
All right. Well, somebody just walked in a bunch of Fandango coupons, so I may be
there you go.
Maybe seeing some free flicks this week.
All right.
So let's talk about something that makes you happy.
Yeah.
Because you did a tour in New York City.
We're going to talk about that thing that makes me happy.
You were raving about. Yeah. What was the other thing that makes you happy?
Well, I thought we were going to talk about the other TV shows that you I already caved on.
All right, let's go there. Let's go there.
Fish will always be there, by the way. Okay. Mr. Robot and Fargo are both fresh in my brain. Fargo, which I watched on your specific recommendation, though it had been recommended previously, was amazing. Amazing.
So great.
I mean, both seasons, phenomenal. I actually think I liked the first season a little better, and it's not a diss on the second season at all, but I am a Billy Bob Thornton fan, especially when he gets to play a wacky psycho.
And he's excellent.
He was in top form as a wacky psycho in season one, and to me, both seasons, the stories were compelling. Are we spoiling?
I think at this point.
Season, I think we can probably spoil.
Season ran, it's over.
Okay.
Feel free to, you know, if you like Fargo or if you're interested in watching Fargo, now's your chance to jump.
These are not going to be the biggest spoilers, but I will say the reason I think if I had to give a reason for liking the first over the second season, it would be a slight demerit to the second season over the odd alien thing.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't pay off. It had seemingly no purpose. Okay. Maybe we should start with every episode of Fargo says at the beginning, this is a true story. It's been told exactly the way it happened, with the exception of names being changed, is the basic gist.
Right. Now, is that real? I will say there is some historical basis for the UFO thing. So the UFO sightings and chatter were popular in that area of the country around that time.
Were these cases actually cold?
Are you asking me if there was a confirmed UFO sighting in Minnesota or South Dakota in the late 70s?
Obviously not.
Because I feel like that would be a bigger story.
asking is, was there a, elaborate gang murder case that involved a UFO, purported UFO sighting?
No.
Look, okay. So that's just BS at the beginning. I figured it was, but I just wanted to make sure.
Like, this is not, that line comes from Fargo, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe
it does.
Which
is also not a true story. It's, I guess, essentially saying this is going to be a verite style, maybe,
right,
of filmmaking.
Right.
Or,
so my first question, just in general, is like, is that cool?
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool. It's kind of a neat storytelling device, and they sort of changed the perspective of the way the story is being told. Like, they had that one where they brought Martin Freeman in as the British narrator who's, uh-huh, like reading this from a book,
right,
what I mean? It's kind of like, I don't know, just I thought a really interesting way to frame the story.
Oh, I thought so for sure. I agree with that. I spent time thinking about it. You know what I mean? Like, there were moments in both seasons where it was like something happened and I was like, wait a second, is this like real crime stuff in some way? And I kind of knew it wasn't, but that still was something that affected my watching, undoubtedly.
Yeah. The reason that I prefer season two to season one, and like you, I want to say that in a way that I think in no way is it meant to diminish season one, because I think season one's great. Whereas, you talk about the Billy Bob Thornton performance in season one, season two had so many people doing so, like, there's so many great performances.
Yeah. Some of them for people.
Yeah. Ugh. Like, you had no idea they had it in them. I mean, Gene Smart, like, where did that come from?
Wait, hold on. I'm going to pull up, Bokeem Woodbine's filmography.
IMDb. It's more than you think. Like, the guy's been a good working actor.
Well, he's been in everything. Yeah. He's been in stuff for 30 years, but man, I don't know if he's just never had a part that juicy that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of TV. I mean, he's been in a lot of B-movies. The Night Crew, AWOL 72, Guardian Angel. These are the last couple of years. I never heard of these movies. Jarhead 2. Bokeem Woodbine has been wasted, and we never knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Think about, for a second, the career, and this is, to me, what's amazing about it, of Landry.
Yeah, Jesse Clemens.
Yes, and that's the thing, is like, if I sat here for another 2 minutes, I would have come up with Jesse Plemons as his name. Mm-hmm. But, like, he's still basically Landry from Friday Night Lights.
And he has been the
three all-time television classics now.
I was going to say, of all those people on that show, he'd have been one of the last you'd have thought, oh, he's going to have a heck of a career after Friday Night Lights. And instead, it turns out he may have been the most successful as an actor. Now, Taylor Kitsch is making more money.
Well, Michael B. Jordan is, I think, you know, headed towards stardom.
Well, I don't count him. He's not really a Friday Night Lights guy.
He's not original cast in your mind?
He's not original cast, but it's more he's Wallace.
Yeah.
From The Wire. That's who Michael B. Jordan is for me. And yeah, obviously he was on Friday Night Lights for the last season.
No, for like four seasons, right? Like the Vince character was in there for
I think it was two seasons at the most.
Yeah.
I think it was only two. Because he wasn't even in the first – he wasn't in any of the original storylines.
He came in when they went to East Dillon. He was
right,
the
which was
second
the
to East Dillon part.
Which was the – if not the last, probably the second to last season, wasn't
I think
it?
They might have had three East Dillon seasons at least.
God, that seems crazy. Let's see here. Television – Friday Night Lights, 26 episodes, so I think just two.
All right.
Anyway, the point is, of that original cast, certainly, Michael B. Jordan's on another level from any of those people, you're right, but of the original cast of Friday Night Lights with my Hebrew school classmate Zach Guilford and Taylor Kitsch and all the beautiful young women who were on that show, Jesse Plemons has done the most interesting stuff afterwards.
Yeah, we may be at the point where we're never going to hear from Minka Kelly again.
I don't think we will. And even Adrian Palicki, who is still in stuff occasionally, has not had the career I hoped for her.
Yeah.
Anyway, Fargo is tremendous. It's probably the best made television show, I think that I've ever seen, not on a premium channel.
You can talk about the acting, which is fantastic, but really it's well made across the board. The cinematography is incredible and really gorgeous. The music is perfect.
The music's great.
It's well considered down to every detail, and just the depth of performances and characters and the writing, and it's an achievement. And there's a lesson here, which is watch something when I recommend it.
All right. That's another argument. I get it. I think, though, the lesson here really in the real world is, and I guess people loved Mad Men, and Breaking Bad was certainly a great time, but Fargo to me is the first show I can think of on a regular cable channel that feels like elite programming, the way that The Wire or Sopranos or, that does.
I would disagree with that. I absolutely put Breaking Bad, especially. I think Breaking Bad's the GOAT.
Really?
Yeah. And Mad Men, both in that company.
Well, I didn't watch Mad Men. I loved Breaking Bad, but I did think it was, it has great acting. It's really well done. You're right. That's probably the first one.
It's a really well-constructed show. And the thing about Breaking Bad, and to me this is the thing that puts it ahead of The Sopranos, certainly, and probably The Wire.
I can't get down with that last one, but go on.
Is that the story starts great, and it never falters. That show continued to get better as it went.
I would say the story had
to its completely satisfying conclusion.
I would agree that it starts great and ends great. It had some bumps in the road. It didn't have Lost-sized bumps in the road, but it had some bumps in the road.
The Wire has the last season is not,
Well,
It's not what the other seasons are, though.
The stakes are a little different, but I still thought it was tremendous television.
Yeah, look. We're picking nits.
We are.
We're talking about top five TV shows.
But you're right. Breaking Bad belongs in the conversation, certainly. But Fargo, to me, I don't know, something about... I don't know if I could say it was better than Breaking Bad. Maybe it was a little more filmic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe. By the way, FX does some other shows that I think are...
Well, we've talked about some of their shows that are really good.
Yeah, like they're doing works good as HBO. as good as the Top Flight stuff that was on AMC.
Yeah.
AMC now seems to be a little bit more about, we're going to, you know, franchise out The Walking Dead, which is a popular show as opposed to a great show.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, not knocking Walking Dead. If you like, I watch it, you know.
All right, cool.
But it's not.
It's not on the level of a Fargo. Yeah. No, not at all. Which actually brings me to Mr. Robot. Because I sort of got my Mr. Robot recommendations in the same way I got my Fargo recommendations, which was like, one day I didn't know that there was a show called Mr. Robot, and like a week later, 15 people had told me it was the greatest thing they'd ever seen. And it was it was another TV show that's really well done, that has some really good acting performances, and an interesting story. But I do think maybe it's a little overrated. And I think while watching Fargo made me go, oh my god, it's hard to believe something this good is on TV all the time, watching Mr. Robot made me go, okay, it's got all the aspects of a really quality television program, and it fits this sort of new genre of prestige TV, but it's not on the level of some of these other things I've been watching.
I agree totally. I enjoyed Mr. Robot. I'd recommend Mr. Robot. Recommending it to you if you're listening right now.
Yes, a lot of fun, a good time, and because we just recommended it and probably less people have seen it, I will not spoil it, but it is as derivative as any sort of entertainment programming can be.
Yeah, well, certainly there's a movie that it takes some very clear cues from and doesn't shy away from. Like,
no.
They know what they're doing.
It's basically like, hey, you guys, we took this movie that you guys really loved and we made a television show that's almost exactly like it in a lot of ways. And then we mixed in some other elements from some other old TV shows and movies that we liked.
Yeah. So I don't... And I don't necessarily think that taking something on its face, you know, it makes it bad. I found like it's a show that has a little bit of a barrier for entry. It took me a couple episodes. There were definitely some points where I'm like, I don't know what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
And I think right now, you know, explaining the plot to someone, I feel like would be a bit of a challenge. Like it's a thick, dense show with its own kind of rhythm. So,
and it also it's a show that, and this is something that I think Fargo somewhat meaningfully did not do, because Fargo has so many characters and so many twists and turns in the story, but by the time you reach the end, everything feels necessary and relevant and participatory.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Mr. Robot had some real things that like. Almost were like artistic asides, you know, like storylines that were like, okay, that's kind of interesting and not poorly done or poorly acted, but they never came back around. They never felt totally necessary. Stuff like that where loose narrative ends that right. did not happen in a show like Fargo. And I think perhaps watching them back to back was a bad deal for Mr. Robot.
I mean, you think about the accomplishments of Fargo. And I think one of the reasons why I like the second season a little bit more than the first is that, you know, now you're telling a wholly original story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you've really moved on from the original source material, mostly. The first one largely moved on. This one almost totally moved on. And yet, not only are they writing this great story that stands up on its own and ties in all these things, they're also, while that's happening, weaving in all these tributes to Coen Brothers movies and all of these references, and they all work organically within the story. Like, it's just a feat of writing.
I thought, and especially if we're to sort of believe what the credits say about Fargo, which is that the Coen Brothers are really just executive producers.
Yeah.
I almost think what the writers and creators of Fargo did was a little dangerous in that they really had to hit those notes right to not piss off their executive producers, right?
Yeah.
The Coen Brothers are kind of picky, finicky guys, as I understand it, and probably pretty protective of their original art. And so to take all those, like, to have it be almost a send-up of a Coen Brothers movie while at the same time having just an incredible drama, I was just so impressed by the whole thing.
Yeah. As I understand it, Noah Hawley, who's kind of the creative force behind the show, I think had earned a little capital with the Coen Brothers after the first season.
Uh-huh.
So I think there was some trust there that they understood his respect for the material.
Right.
You know what I mean? That he wasn't going to take it anywhere too crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, even the, you know, the one spoiler we gave that where they mix in some weird UFO stuff, it felt very Coen Brothers-y.
Yeah.
Very much.
Oh, sure.
So.
Sure did. Yeah. Sure did. Yeah. Great stuff. Great stuff.
Great All stuff. Right, All right. Do we want to dive into Fish? Is that too much to ask?
I'm going to table Fish for now.
Okay.
Because, like I said, there are literally whole podcasts that have been done on the subject of.
Yeah. Analyze Fish. R.I.P. Yeah. Harris Whittles. We could probably. The difference between we wouldn't be able to mimic what they did because you've heard too much. Like you're already in the bag for the enemy. There's no fixing you.
I don't think there is at this point.
Yeah.
For those we've had this discussion before, and for people who don't know, I've been to, I've heard Fish records. I've been to Fish concerts. I've probably made more of an effort with this band that I don't like than any other band that I don't like, and
yeah. I would still be interested, and this betrays my somewhat obsession. I would still be interested in making certain attempts because I do think the band has changed in ways that you would call improvements. If we want to
table that, are they writing songs with beginning, middles, and ends now? Or
well, actually, I think you could argue their songwriting is more traditional on their newer records, but that's not really what I meant.
Okay.
Can I sneak in then before we quit this experience I had over my daytime in New York during my Fish run?
Yeah, you can, because that's actually where I was going originally with trying to talk about something that made you happy. I want to hear about your Bronx hip hop tour.
Yes. Okay. I thought you were going Fish tour when you started with that, but I'm glad we snuck in the TV shows. Okay. There is an app, which I am now going to give a free advertisement for to a degree, called Detour. It's really essentially still in beta stages. My mother, when she visited me in the Bay Area, the main spot for the app is the Bay Area. And it's basically a little audio tour app. So you pay a certain amount for different tours, or you can buy like a package of tours or whatever, and you throw on your headphones in whatever city you're in, and, you know, I should probably just pull up an example of one of the San Francisco ones, but, like, it'll be like, you know, you're in the Tenderloin, and here's a tour of, like, some historic things in this particular neighborhood. The first San Francisco one is the Castro, and it's a 11 mile. No, that's how far it is for me right now. it's a tour, a walking tour, hour and 30 minutes through the Castro, and it is narrated by Cleve Jones, who was the Emil Hirsch character in the movie Milk. And so it's real people who are part of the history of a place in your headphones as you walk around, and it's got all these incredible things where it's like linked to your GPS, so it waits for you to get to the right place to tell you the story about it. You can like sync it with the other people you're with, all that sort of stuff. So the point of explaining all this is there's like free previews in a few other cities that are not San Francisco, and one of them is New York, which has three tours, two about Hasidic Jews, which nothing against Hasidic Jews, but I had my own Jewish experience as a child, and I chose not to do those ones. And a third tour, which is called Soundwalk Presents the Bronx, Birth of Hip Hop with Jazzy J and Afrika Bambaataa.
Wow.
And basically, and that wasn't it, by the way. It also had Grand Wizard Theodore and you know, probably ultimately 10 different voices over the course of this thing. That was about an hour and 20 minutes long. And literally, me and my friends hopped off the train in the Bronx, the 6 train, right next to the Bronx River Houses projects, and, like, wandered through as we heard awesome old hip-hop music and then got to listen to Jazzy J talk about what it was like growing up there, how they got started, like the sort of these like crazy hip-hop parties they would have. They walked us to like this stage in the middle of the Bronx River Houses where they would have like a party every Friday that like essentially founded an entire genre of music. So first of all, the tour itself was awesome. And we literally walked probably like 8 blocks through a project housing development, past a school, and back to the train. Like, it wasn't even that much of a thing. It was amazing to listen to. It was amazing to hear these dudes talk about their history. But also, the thing it got me thinking about, now that I'm done with my free app commercial, is...
Wait, can I just ask you, do they have, like, a Minneapolis one that only works from June to September?
That's funny. They have Chicago in their coming soon. It's basically, San Francisco's the only one with a full complement. New York City has a free preview. Austin has a free preview. London and Paris and Berlin have free previews, as do Barcelona and Marrakesh. And Chicago and Los Angeles both say coming soon.
There you go. By the way, you're talking to a man who's taken 12 walking tours of San Francisco before.
Okay,
so.
Yeah. So I've not done the San Francisco ones. But what they're doing with this stuff is amazing. And I got the feeling that there is, to a degree, there's some culling of audio tours that already exist to include in the app. So San Francisco may include ones you've taken. But the particular tour of the Bronx and hip-hop roots got me really thinking about trying to think of the right way to put this, but the effect of struggle on art. So much of mankind's best art is created in opposition to huge challenges constantly, all the time. Whether that's internal challenges, you know, Van Gogh being crazy and cutting his ear off, or if it's more like what a depressed group of, you know, systematically oppressed is probably a better word, group of minorities do, because they can do it cheaply and it's their best way to create in the Bronx River houses, was to get all the old records they could. And then, you know, discussions about like going three boroughs away to find some old funk record so that you could be the guy that had the one copy of this record at the party, and like turning that into sampling, and just the way it all developed sort of in response to and because of the challenges that were there. I guess this is more a general rumination, but I was asking myself, like, what is it about humans that makes us at our most creative against the worst odds?
Yeah, I think that that's woven through the history of art, right?
Yeah.
And I would say crappy odds probably breed creativity in a sense, right? In the way that necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
In the way that it's easier for the Rolling Stones to write great rock and roll songs when they're, you know, or actually, you know, what's a better example? This is Guns N' Roses.
Right.
It's much easier to write for Guns N' Roses to write great rock and roll songs when they're scruffy wastoids living three to a crappy one-bedroom apartment in L.A. Than it is when they're obscenely rich. And you can see the difference in the quality of output.
Is that just want to, though? Is it deeper than just want to? Is it just, I got to get out of here, so I got to do something, so I got to make something great?
Well, no, I mean, I think it's some of it's want to. I think some of it is art is observation. And right, your observation changes as your means change and your problems change. You know what I mean? Your bubble kind of changes.
Yeah.
So I think there's some of that, too. I think it's just... You know, I think it's an inevitable product of human nature.
Yeah. Know? No, I agree. It has to be. Historically, it's such an incredibly consistent pattern. In fact, struggle in one way or another might be the most correlative thing we can attach to good art historically.
Right. No, I would say that's fair.
Yeah, whether it's oppression or internal struggle or, you know, a particular individual struggle, like... Some sort of strife has led to a huge percentage of the great art.
Yeah. You know, if you're Malcolm Gladwell, you'd say time to the craft as well.
Of course.
Yeah. All right. I know we got to go soon. I did want to throw out, since it's happening this week, Baseball Hall of Fame inductions are coming up. And it's just struck me, this is not a new thought. You know, the Hall of Fame's a mess.
Yes.
Right now. Not just for the obvious steroid candidates, how how do we take this, you know, how do we handle this issue? You know, that's a mess. But I think now there's kind of a new mess coming up with the, you know, as specialization has increased in baseball, how does the Hall of Fame deal with that? You know, I think Trevor Hoffman to me is a really interesting example because Trevor Hoffman's a guy who's going to have a case to get into the Hall of Fame.
You said that in a way that makes me think you don't think he belongs.
I don't think he belongs. You know, he's going to get in because he did this one, you know, he did this one specialized thing than anyone else. But then you get into
more.
Like,
he did it really well.
He did it well. I don't know that he did it so much better than, like, I don't know, for example, that he's doing it better than Craig Kimbrell's doing it right now. You know what I mean? If you look at the periphery numbers of Trevor Hoffman, like they're pretty good. They're not amazing.
Let me throw this just quickly. For a 10-year stretch, 96 to 06, so 11 years really. He averaged 45 saves a year with an ERA under 2.5 and an ERA plus of 161 and 10 strikeouts per 9.
All right.
That's a pretty great 10-year stretch.
Yeah, it's pretty good. What's his career WAR?
His career WAR player value is 28.
So he was worth, over the entire course of his career, he was worth 28 more wins than the average player. That is not great.
But that's not a great stat for closers.
Right, but that's my whole point, is because, you know, you're talking about a guy who over his entire career only impacted the game over 1,000 innings.
Well, then would your argument be that in general a lower percentage of closers than of first basemen should be in the Hall? Because that's what the question comes down
to. I would say absolutely. But I would say, look, if you want to say that, okay, well, he did this thing and he's the best among the guys to do that, I think whether or not he's the best is, you know, that's a marginal case that probably could also be discussed. But if you want to say that, how then is Edgar Martinez not in the Hall of Fame?
Well, Edgar Martinez should be in the Hall of Fame. You'll get no argument from me there. He absolutely should be. Just like, you know, Ray Guy should be in the NFL Hall of Fame.
You know, so it becomes like, and then where does that stop? Like, are we going to put the best pinch runner in the Hall of Fame? Or
no,
we put
I don't
the
think
best...
that's fair because pinch runner is not actually a thing anyone aspires to.
All right, are we going to put the best setup man in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, you know? I think at a certain point, that's, yes, I think we are. You know? I think we should. What's greatness
like
in sports? Isn't greatness in sports being one of the best at the thing you do?
I guess, except that we all know that, like,
if there's a soccer Hall of Fame, do goalies not go in?
We right, but that's different because the goalie a goalkeeper's impact on a soccer game is much greater than the goaltender is playing for the entire game.
That's
Trevor
true,
Hoffman
but...
threw 1,000 innings over what, 13 years?
I know, but I'm just making the point. It's a person that affects the game in very distinct scenarios, very quickly and very infrequently.
Curt Schilling, who's a guy I'm not even sure I would vote for, threw roughly the same level performance over three times as many innings, and he's not going to have as good a chance to get in.
But we know,
as Trevor Hoffman.
But we know that those are more difficult innings that Trevor Hoffman is throwing.
We also know that. No, I don't think we do know that.
Really?
And I also think we. Yes, he just threw the ninth inning. How many times did Trevor Hoffman come in up three runs with nobody on and get three guys out and call it a day, and that's a save, quote unquote?
That's fine, but Curt Schilling came into every game 0-0.
We also, yes, but pitched in a lot of situations that were not 0-0 in important games. Not to mention, by the way, if you want to get into high leverage, his performance in the postseason. And we also know this, and this is, I think, maybe the key element when you're discussing closers, is that if somebody had wanted to make Curt Schilling a closer and said you only have to throw one inning every game, he would have been an incredible and dominant closer.
Well, we don't know that.
We don't know that.
We don't
do that. Yes, because all all pitchers start off as starters, and all relievers, by necessity, are essentially failed starters.
What about John Smoltz?
What about John Smoltz? By the way, John Smoltz, who, you know, I revere, and I think, you know...
I revere?
At least one of my all-time favorites.
I know.
You know, I think he's pretty much proof of this, right? He was a great starter, you know.
Well, but he was moved to closer out of necessity at closer, wasn't he? More than...
Moved to A, to, in an attempt to save his arm, and B, because they didn't have a closer. Yeah. Did great at that, but by the way, was like, I want to go back to starting. You know what I mean? And he did.
Okay, so, and that's fine, but my point is simply the fact that he spent, what, 4 years as a closer doesn't make me think those are the 4 worst years of his career. Yeah. Those are 4 years he did a different job, but also did that job really well.
Right, yeah. And that's,
he got
that's
MVP fun. Votes in 3 of those years he was a closer.
Yeah, that's insane.
I know,
by the way,
but I'm just saying.
Can you throw those Trevor Hoffman stats at me again real quick, the career stats? Sorry.
I certainly could in theory if I had kept that window open.
Okay.
Hold on. I'll get back to him. You want the 10 years or you want the...
Give me that 10-year stretch, yeah.
Okay, I got to highlight it again. By the way, thanks, Baseball Reference, for making things like this so easy. Yeah. It was so hard to have these arguments so long, like 10 years ago. All right, so the 10-year stretch, what do you want to know?
Give me the... give me the ERA plus again.
ERA plus is 161.
Okay. Craig Kimbrell, through 6 years, his ERA plus is currently 233.
Yeah.
Give me the, what's the strikeouts per nine?
10.
Kimbrell is 14.5.
Yeah, okay. If your point is that Craig Kimbrell is a better closer than Trevor Hoffman maybe ever was, I'm not sure I disagree with that.
Here's my point is that I could do the same thing with Aroldis Chapman. I could do the
Would you not agree we're sort of in a heyday of closers? There were not other Trevor Hoffmans when Trevor Hoffman was going. There were Mariano Rivera.
There was
Rivera and Trevor Hoffman and a bunch of other guys that had a year or two.
Do you think that Trevor Hoffman was a markedly better pitcher than Francisco Rodriguez?
He's a guy who played for 20 years, and Francisco Rodriguez has had maybe 5 good years in his career.
He was probably, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't know that the difference between that guy and, you know, some of the guys are pitching now and some of the, like, I just don't know that the disparity is that great to say that this guy deserves to go into the Hall of Fame over a guy like Mike Mussina.
Okay, well, should we pull people out of the Hall of Fame that pitched 100 years ago? Because if I go to some of their stats and compare them to Zach Greinke, you know, they're going to be embarrassed.
Look, I mean, you have to do some adjusting for era. Look, I'm not even saying, hey, this closer mess is the specialization mess that's coming is the biggest part of the thing. But understand, right, there has to be some prioritization. There's a limit to how many people guys can vote for.
So over that 10-year stretch, just as an example, over that 10-year stretch, Hoffman's whip was under one the whole time. Francisco Rodriguez has had a whip under one only 3 times, and 2 of those were the last 2 years.
Okay.
Let's see.
By the way, just because I'm on the page, in 2012, Craig Kimbrell's whip was 0.654.
Craig Kimbrell will probably be a Hall of Famer, won't he?
I hope he will, but I don't know that he will. There are definitely people who are like, I'm voting for Mariano Rivera, and that's the only closer I'm ever going to vote for.
Well, I think that's silly, because closers have become a critical component to a successful baseball team.
I think an overrated component, but yes, they're a critical component.
I mean, maybe slightly overrated, but not that overrated.
I mean, look, middle relief is gaining in prominence, right?
Starters are pitching shorter and shorter outings, but
could we see them coming to the Hall? I don't know that we're ever going to answer these questions. I guess my original question was, between this and between the steroid mess, which is just out of hand. My God, poor Jeff Bagwell. I can't even, like, it drives me insane.
Is it poor Jeff Bagwell, though?
Yes, it's poor Jeff Bagwell.
All right.
Jeff Bagwell, statistically, is without a doubt one of the top 10 first basemen of all time. And even if you eye test him down from there, he's certainly Hall of Fame worthy. He's never had even a hint of of steroid accusation leveled at him as a player.
Publicly.
Yes. There's literally zero proof.
And well, there's yet, zero proof of any. Show me the proof of Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds.
Not even, well, I mean, Game of Shadows is a pretty definitive account of Barry Bonds' steroid use.
It's a definitive account, but there's no definitive
Clemens
proof.
Is the Mitchell report. I shouldn't say proof. There's no evidence. There's no suspicion. There's no public evidence. There's nothing.
No, there's what I would call reasonable suspicion, but otherwise you're right.
But what is the reasonable suspicion?
That a guy with that body who hit a lot of home runs during that era. I mean, I think everybody.
I guess. I mean, he was also an athletic guy who stole a lot of bases. There's no weird performance decline. There's nothing. It's just kind of like, well, he was around that time, and I don't totally believe it. That's the case against Jeff Bagwell, basically. And
well, that's probably true. There's some home run jumps, but yeah, it's basically a timing issue.
Yeah, look, I'm a guy that I don't think steroids has not bothered me at all. I put them all in.
But
you know, there are people who are sort of picking and choosing. Is there a way that baseball?
Are they picking and choosing though? Because I think it's pretty consistent. They may not have the right standard of evidence for Jeff Bagwell, but I think the people who are saying I don't care about steroids are voting that way, and the people who are saying I, for whatever idiotic reason, care about steroids, are voting that way.
No, because there are people who are like, I'm going to vote for Bonds and Clemens, but not these other guys, right?
Right. Well, that's the old tricky judgment of, well, they were great without the steroids.
Right. Everyone's applying their own standard. Like, is there somebody who can come in and say, look, this is how we're going to handle the steroids?
Yeah, there are multiple people.
Here are our guidelines.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Just like every Hall of Fame needs that.
How we're going to apply the character clause. And why, if so, why isn't that happening?
Because they're scared. Right? It's fear. It's fear that they'll be the people that end up somehow on the wrong side of history if we make this clear and our clear designation turns out to be looked unfavorably upon in 20 years, then we're the asshole. Right now, the writers are the assholes because they have to make an impossible decision based on meaningless criteria.
Yeah, now that talk about a group of guys who are like willing to step up and be the assholes.
Yeah, baseball writers happy to take that. That's true.
Yes, they are all about taking it on. And then it's just like I find myself getting mad at the writers, you know?
I pretty much agree. It's frustrating. And you know, baseball, more than any of the other Hall of Fames, which really is just football. I mean, the Basketball Hall of Fame is a whole weird deal that has college and pro. It's not the NBA doesn't really have a Hall of Fame. So we're basically talking about football and baseball. And football, at least, has a reasonably small group of reasonably well-informed individuals who then have a discussion, which at least, even though the criteria is ill-conceived, I can at least get behind the process. Baseball has hundreds of people, at least 100 of whom haven't watched baseball in the last 5 years, and didn't watch carefully when they were watching, and they're all just voting willy-nilly with no instructions whatsoever. It's absurd.
Yeah, I don't, you know, so is it the BBWA that fixes this? Is it Rob Manfred?
It has to be either baseball or the Baseball Hall of Fame, which are technically separate groups, right?
Entities, yes, correct.
But if baseball as a sport, i.e. Rob Manfred and company, say, here's what we think are the appropriate criteria to vote on Hall of Fame, my understanding is the Hall of Fame will more or less go along with that. Or the Hall of Fame has to say, and again, I think those two organizations would have to work in concert because neither could really move on this without the other. But if they can't, why can't they just sit down and say, here's some issues. Here's how we judge. You know, we don't know who used steroids, so forget that. Judge people on their relative ability to the other players in their time, you know?
Right.
They will still have some rogue writers that will refuse to vote for Bonds, but it would do a huge service to the process.
We still have people who are refusing to vote people in, because they don't want them to get in unanimously. Like, that's still a thing.
That's, Yeah, exactly. You know? Like, in the last, it's absurd. I mean, Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez.
Greg Maddux.
There's no question these people are Hall of Famers. Literally everyone knows it, and yet not a one of them had a higher than 97.3% election,
like,
right?
You can't, like, you literally can't make an argument against them.
No. Ricky Henderson. Guess what? 5.2% of people did not vote for Ricky Henderson to get into the Hall of Fame. I mean, what are you doing?
Why have a Hall of Fame if Ricky Henderson's not going to be in it?
It's ridiculous.
We'll tell you that, Ricky Henderson.
The highest one, I went back to 99 to get Nolan Ryan at 98.8.
Mm-hmm. And didn't vote for him either.
That's about as high as it gets. So there are people out there not voting for Nolan Ryan to get into the Hall of Fame. What are you doing? You don't belong in any sort of voting party about baseball.
Is there a point at which you stop caring about the Hall of Fame?
Oh, yeah. It was a while ago.
Okay. So that point exists, and we passed it long ago. Much like the end of this podcast.
Yeah, agreed. I think that should do it. Skype worked, though, so we got that going.
Yeah, yay. Thanks to Skype. Thanks to you for listening. Tell a friend, you know?
Yeah, tell all your friends. Why just one?
Because that's how people are going to find out about this. I don't think we're getting a spot on the iTunes front page anytime soon.
Well, cross your fingers.
Okay, fingers are crossed. We'll talk to you guys next week.
All right, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed, the light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.